Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 1. Just who is this Patriarch Judah? Watchman's Teaching Letter, Number 7, November 1998. From the 1998 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmeheiser. Read by Dan Adams. Just who is this Patriarch Judah? Part 7. In the last issue, I showed how the Ashkenazi and Sephardim Jews have been mixed for the last 1,275 years, since the conversion of King Bulan in 740 AD, to spread the satanic blood of Cain among all of them. There is no such thing as a good Jew. You will remember that in lesson number 4, I said that Judah had become both a blessing and a curse. In this session, we are going to discuss the process of how Judah became a curse. Judah becomes a curse. If you have not read lessons number 2 and number 3, along with my research papers proving two seed lines seduction of Eve, I advise you to do so, as it will help you in understanding the lesson we are about to study here. In lessons 2 and 3, we discussed Judah's personal family life and established the following. Judah was entrapped by a Canaanite woman, Bathsheba, into marrying her and having 3 half-breed children by her, Onan, and Shelah. We have a question here. If once trapped into marrying someone, does one have 3 children with them? People do all the time. I'm saying that Judah was more than guilty, and almost as guilty as Esau. Continuing. Judah obtains a wife, Tamar, of pure Adamic blood, from the house of Shem, for But he ejaculates on the ground rather than consummate the marriage, and Yahweh kills him. Judah gives Onan to Tamar as a Levirite for whereupon he does the same as his brother, and Yahweh kills him also. Judah promises his 3rd son Shelah to Tamar as soon as he reaches marrying age, and sends Tamar to her father's house. Shelah reaches marrying age, whereupon Bathsheba, his mother, marries him to a Canaanite woman, causing a total breach of contract with Tamar, and then Bathsheba shortly thereafter dies. Tamar being still a maiden and Judah an eligible widower, Tamar decides upon a very daring plan to trick Judah into supplying the seed to fulfill the contract by feigning to be a common whore, and twin boys were born by this union of Judah and Tamar, Phares and Zara. Else there would not have been any tribe of Judah. We know what happened to and Onan, but whatever happened to Shelah? That is the topic of this lesson, for with Shelah, Judah became a curse. The half-breed Shelah and his Canaanite descendants became a very prominent family living among the Israelites, and it is very important that we understand what happened to him and his descendants. Even the best Bible students have never figured out what happened to this family. After this lesson, you will be among the very few who will know this fuller extent of the descendants of Shelah. In Genesis 38:5, 11, 14, and 26, we are told of Shelah's birth, Judah's promise to Tamar to give Shelah in marriage to Tamar's plan to avoid Shelah and choose Judah for a husband rather than Shelah, and Judah's acknowledgement of his broken promise to give Shelah to Tamar. Let's read these 4 passages. And she again conceived and bare a son, and called his name Shelah. And he was at Chezlib when she bare him. Then said Judah to Tamar his daughter-in-law, Remain a widow at thy father's house till Shelah, my son, be grown. for he said, lest peradventure he die also, as his brethren did. And she put her widow's garments off from her, and covered her with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place, which is by the way to Timnath, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given unto him to wife. And Judah acknowledged them, and said, She hath been more righteous than I, because that I gave her not to Shelah my son. And Judah knew her Tamar again no more. The next reference in the Bible concerning Shelah is found in Genesis 46:12, and reads thusly, And the sons of Judah, and Onan, and Shelah, and Pharez, and Zarah. But and Onan died in the land of Canaan. And the sons of Pharez were Hezron and Hamul. In the next passage we are going to consider, there is a slight variation or corruption in the names of the descendants of Shelah. As we go along with the study, we are going to discover several variations or corruptions of the names of the descendants of Shelah. We will now read Numbers 26, verses 20 and 21. And the sons of Judah, after their families, were of Shelah, the family of the Shelonites, of Pharez, the family of the Pharezites, of Zerah, the family of the Zerahites. And the sons of Pharez were of Hezron, the family of the Hezronites, of Hamul, the family of the Hamulites. We should take particular notice here to the order in which Judah's sons are mentioned. It is important to notice this because it presents a problem. The order in which Judah's children were born was 1 2 Onan, 3 Shelah, 4 Pharez, and 5 Zerah. We know that Yahweh killed and Onan, leaving Shelah to be the next in line for the birthright, and also Tamar's husband. But Shelah was bypassed completely, and Pharez was considered the firstborn. This is why the midwife took special attention to mark the first one of the twins to be born, but as in the case of Reuben, when he was disqualified as firstborn of Jacob and Leah, the honor went to the firstborn of Jacob and Rachel, or Joseph. Evidently, when there was a different woman involved, and the original firstborn is dead or disqualified, the honor of firstborn went to the firstborn of the second union. You will remember that Ishmael was the firstborn of Abraham, but when Isaac was born to him by Sarah, Isaac was considered the firstborn. I only found one comment in all my commentaries on the above verse, which I don't think is quite right, but I will use it anyway, and it was in A Commentary on the Holy Bible by Matthew Poole, Volume 1, page 320. The sons of Pharez were, though Judah's grandchildren, are here mentioned among his sons, because they were put in the stead of and Onan, which died before. This may be true, but I would rather believe that Pharez simply was put in Ur's stead. It is rather interesting, though, after the three families of Judah are recorded in their birth order, only Pharez's children are mentioned. I would say this is because Pharez's children were in the royal line, and this is the reason they were mentioned here in this passage. Going on now to 1 Chronicles 2, verses 3 through 5, we have Shelah's name mentioned at the beginning of a long chapter, which includes verses 3 through 55. In this genealogy of Judah, it gets off to a bad start with Shelah, and has a bad ending with the Kenites in verse 55. Everything in between is the pure line of Judah. As I have covered the Kenites, the descendants of Cain, in my other writings, I will not go into that subject here. Although the Kenites are a very important subject, and should be understood by all in identity. We will only use verses 3 and 4 at this time. The sons of Judah, Uran, Onan, and Shelah, which three were born unto him of the daughter of Shua, the Canaanite. And the firstborn of Judah, was evil in the sight of the Lord, and he slew him. And Tamar, his daughter-in-law, bare him Perez and Zerah. All the sons of Judah were five. Now we come to a very interesting passage concerning Shelah and his descendants. I will have more than the normal amount of comment on this passage. This passage will start to open up the subject of Shelah, and we will be able to start to get a perspective as to what kind of people he and his descendants were and their manner of lifestyle. Before making any comments, we'll first read the passage, 1 Chronicles 4, verses 21 through 23. The sons of Shelah, the son of Judah, were named for his eldest brother, the father of Lekah, and La'ada, the father of Marashah, and the families of the house of them that wrought fine linen of the house of Ashboah, and Jochim, and the men of Chozeba, and Joash, and Sarah, who had the dominion in Moab, and Jashubilim, and these are ancient things. These were the potters, and those that dwelt among plants and hedges. There they dwelt with the king for his work. You'll notice here that Shelah and his household were known as producers of fine linen and were also potters. At this time I wish to read from a small pamphlet entitled David's Greater Son, written by Howard B. Rand, concerning Shelah, page 6. Thus from Zerah's line came the progenitors of the Milesian civilization that was established around the shores of the Mediterranean Sea. However, although they were descendants of Judah, they were not Jews, as we think of Jews today. The descendants of Shelah, who were workers in fine linen, 1 Chronicles 4:21, left the rest of Israel shortly after the Exodus, and before Israel entered the Promised Land, joining with their brethren of the Zara line in their westward trek. They became the progenitors of the linen workers in Ireland in the Isles. If so, nevertheless, whether of Judah or not, they would be of mixed satanic blood. Continuing. I have done some research on this last statement of Rand's, that Shelah and his descendants moved into Ireland with the line of Zerah. What Rand is doing is assuming, because Shelah and his children are mentioned in 1 Chronicles 4:21 as being famous for fine linen, and the Irish also later became famous for their linen, there must be some connection. I have a lot of respect for Howard B. Rand's writings, but I don't believe everything he teaches. I believe this is one of the places where Rand goofed. I think I have everything Howard B. Rand ever put out in my library, and I value it very highly. To show you why I think Rand is wrong in this case, I will now quote from the World Book Encyclopedia, Volume 12, page 294. Modern use of linen began in Europe in the 1600s. Skilled Flemish and French workers who left their countries to escape religious persecution helped develop linen spinning and weaving in England, the Netherlands, and Germany. Linen fabrics from France, Belgium, and Ireland have become famous throughout the world. There you have it. Ireland learned the making of linen from the Flemish as an indirect result of religious persecution in modern times. Can you now see how dangerous it is to assume something like Rand did? Yes. There is obviously no connection between the linen business of the family of Shelah in Palestine and later in Ireland. None. Though there may be Shelahites in Ireland, I have never as yet seen any historical evidence of it. If I ever do, I will write about it. In this lesson, we will find some of the places they did go, though. We will start with Matthew Henry's Commentary, Volume 2, pages 846 and 847. Matthew Henry doesn't have it entirely correct, but it will serve to give us a general idea of what 1 Chronicles 4:21 and 23 is all about. As I quote from different sources, each source will contribute small items of evidence to help clear up the overall picture. Each source will also have a certain amount of error that we will have to overlook. That another is said to be the father of the house of those that wrought fine linen, verse 21, it is inserted in their genealogy as their honor that they were the best weavers in the kingdom, and they were brought up, their children, from one generation to another to the same business, not aiming to make them gentlemen. This La'ada is said to be the father of those that wrought fine linen, as before the flood. Jubal is said to be the father of musicians, and Jabal of shepherds, etc. His posterity inhabited the city of Marashah, the manufacturer, or staple commodity of which place was linen cloth, with which their kings and priests were clothed. That another family had had dominion in Moab, but were now in servitude in Babylon, verses 23, 22 and 23, it was found among the ancient things that they had the dominion in Moab, probably in David's time, when the country was conquered. They transplanted themselves thither and were put in places of power there, which they held for several generations, but this was a great while ago, time out of mind. Their posterity were now potters and gardeners, as is supposed, in Babylon, where they dwelt with the king for his work, got a good livelihood by their industry, and therefore cared not for returning with their brethren to their own land after the years of captivity had expired. Those that now have dominion know not what their posterity may be reduced to, nor what mean employment they may be glad to take up with. But those were unworthy of the name of Israelites, that could dwell among plants and hedges rather than be at pains to return to Canaan. End quote. The next reference we are going to use will clear up the story of the descendants of Shelah a little more. This will give us more insight into the occupations they followed. It will also give us an idea to what geographic area they may have migrated. It is found in Adam Clark's commentary on the Bible, page 386, verse 23. These were the potters. They were probably brickmakers, perhaps potters also, who had their dwelling in low grounds and fabricated the clay into pots and bricks that was digged up in forming fences in the king's domains. End quote. For another reference, we will use the Wycliffe Bible Commentary, page 372. From Wycliffe, we'll find that we have a problem of translation with the words plants and hedges. The Hebrew words for plants and hedges are better taken as place names, Netaim and Gadara. These were the potters. They dwelt with the king. Archaeology has demonstrated the existence of hereditary guilds of potters during the divided kingdom from 930 to 586 BC, with royal patronage and using regular jar stamps from generation to generation. R.A. Stuart McAllister, Palestine Exploration Fund Quarterly Statement, July and October of 1905, pages 244, 245, 328 and 329. From this, we can see they were actually leaving their trademark wherever they went. They had formed family guilds and didn't let anyone else into their business. Today we would call this a closed corporation. We can also see from this that they were not attending to plants, nor were they trimming hedges, as this is evidently a mistranslation, and should be names of places. With the curse of Cain on them, the plants and hedges would only die if they had attended them. If you have any favorite plants, don't ask a Jew to water them for you while you are on vacation, or when you get home, they will all be dead. From Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, pages 295, we get the following commentary on this passage. Verses 21 through 23, the posterity of Shelah. Verse 21, La'ada, the father of the house of them, that wrought fine linen. Here again is another incidental evidence that in very early times certain traders were followed by particular families among the Hebrews, apparently in hereditary succession. Their knowledge of the art of linen manufacture had been most probably acquired from Egypt, where the duty of bringing up families to the occupations of their forefathers was a compulsory obligation. Whereas in Egypt, whereas in Israel, as in many parts of Asia to this day, it was optional, though common. In verses 22 and 23, had the dominion in Moab and Jashubihelem. And these are ancient things, seems a strange rendering of a proper name, and besides, it conveys a meaning that has no bearing on the record. The following improved translation has been suggested. Sojourned in Moab, but returned to Bethlehem and Adabarim Achekalim. These are hard words to pronounce. These are the inhabitants of Netaim and Gadara, and they were potters employed by the king in his own work. Gadara, or Gederot, and Netaim belonged to the tribe of Judah and lay on the southwest border of the Philistines' territory. Joshua 15, verse 36, 2 Chronicles 28:18. The Revised Standard Version and the James Moffat Bible probably have better renderings on 1 Chronicles 4:23, and they read as follows. The Revised Standard has, "These were the potters and inhabitants of Netaim and Gadara. They dwelt there with the king for his work." And the Moffat Bible has, "This from an ancient archive. These were the potters and inhabitants of Netaim and Gadara. They resided there in the service of the king." Next, I'd like to quote this passage, 1 Chronicles 4:21 through 23, from the New International Version, the NIV. Now, I know there are some reportedly very bad things about the NIV, but in this passage they got it right. "The sons of Shelah, son of Judah, the father of Lekah, La'ada, the father of Marashah, and the clans of the linen workers of Beth Ashbea, Joachim, the men of Kozeba, and Joash and Saraph, who ruled in Moab, and Jashubi Lehem. These records are from ancient times. They were potters who lived in Netaim and Gadara. They stayed there and worked for the king." For all of this, we can see that the children of Shelah were in the textile trade of linen. Just like the Jews of today, they controlled the production of fabrics. And in those days, it was linen. The main building materials in that period of time was bricks, and the sons of Shelah, half-Jews, were controlling that business also. Not only that, but they were in control of the making of dishes and clay pots to store food and water in. Also cups, jars, bowls, jugs, cooking pots, frying pans, lamps, etc. They formed closed guilds, unions, and put their trademark on every item they made. Not only were they doing this in Palestine, but they expanded to Moab and Babylon with their rule and industry. Next, I would like to take a short quote from the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, volume K through Q, pages 848 and 849. "Just as in the Hyksos Renaissance, there had been an upsurge in both ceramics and metallurgy, so in David's day, iron came into its own, along with improved ceramics. The Davidic kingdom, iron too, saw a continuation in better wares and more forms, as well as the introduction of wheel burnishing. And toward the end of that period, however, something entirely new appeared in ceramics, the modern factory techniques, which we use, were created at that time, and mass production appeared. The potter was using assembly line techniques, standardizing his wares, staggering his sizes, and at times even using trademarks. The new techniques permitted the use of cheaper clays, cheaper labor, greater volume production, etc., and yet the quality of the work continued high. The days of Isaiah and Jeremiah witnessed an industrial revolution in various fields, but ceramics seemed to be the most progressive of all." End quote. Now a short quote from page 850 from the same book on the same subject. "The cooking pot was constantly subject to accident and to expansion, shock of heat and cold. It therefore demanded special skill in manufacture, and in the days of the Davidic kingdom, potters often stamped their trademarks on the handles of the wide mouth variety." End quote. At this point, we should be getting a better picture in our minds of the activities of the sons of Shelah. You may be wondering what consideration is there between the making of linen cloth and pottery. Let's use a further quote from the same book under the subject of pottery. "Miscellaneous were, ware," page 852. "In the cloth industry, cheap spindle wards," 2 Samuel 3:29, "spindle," King James Version, "staff," Proverbs 31:19, "spindle," King James Version, "distaff," were sometimes made of pottery, the loom weights, which were used in the weaving of cloth when this industry was at its peak late in the Davidic kingdom, were almost always made of pottery." End quote. You can see from this that the sons of Shelah had both the pottery industry and the linen cloth industry all tied up in their hands, monopolizing it entirely in a large geographic area all the way up to Babylon. The next time in the scriptures we encounter the descendants of Shelah is in the 1 Chronicles 9:5. We're only turning a few pages in our Bible, but we are jumping many years into the future to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah and the return of the Judean captives from Babylon. The first few verses of this passage look back upon the foregone genealogies and tell us they were gathered out of the books of the kings of Israel and Judah. Mentioning Israel and Judah, the historian takes notice of their being carried away to Babylon for their transgressions. Then follows an account of the first inhabitants after their return from captivity that dwell in their cities, especially Jerusalem. Of the different ones that return, in verse 5, we have this record. "And of the Shelonites, Asaiah the firstborn and his sons." What we have to do next is find out who these Shelonites are. Shelonites, spelled S-H-I-L-O-N-I-T-E-S, slightly different spelling from before. At this time, I'm going to cite 8 different references on who the Shilonites are. Matthew Poole's Commentary on the Holy Bible, Volume 1, page 789. Or Shelonites, as they are called from Shelah, Numbers 26:20. Asaiah, A-S-A-I-A-H, called also Maasaiah, M-A-A-S-E-I-A-H, from Nehemiah 6:5. Insight on the Scriptures, Volume 2, page 929, has an alternate form used in the plural for the name of the family that sprang from Judah's third son, Shelah, 1 Chronicles 9:5, Genesis 46:12, and see Shelah, number 2, Shelonites. The Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, volume Arthur Z, page 330, has a designation of a member of one of the Judean families returning from exile, 1 Chronicles 9:5, Nehemiah 11:5. There are numerous differences in the names of the families listed in 1 Chronicles 5:9. Nehemiah 11:5. If Shilonites refers to persons from Shiloh, they trace their ancestry back to a place in the northern kingdom. It is more probable that in both passages should be vocalized Shelahite to indicate a descendant of Shelah of Genesis 38:5, Numbers 26:20. Shilohite in Scripture has two meanings, a man from Shiloh and a descendant of Shelah. Knave's Topical Bible, page 1269, used apparently to denote a descendant of Shelah, 1 Chronicles 9:5. Smith's Dictionary of the Bible, 1890, page 645, Shilonites are mentioned among the descendants of Judah, dwelling in Jerusalem at a time different, difficult to fix, 1 Chronicles 9:5. They are doubtless the members of the house of Shelah, who in the Pentateuch are more accurately designated Shelahites. Popular and Critical Bible Encyclopedia and Scriptural Dictionary, 1901, volume 3, page 1577. The descendants of Judah through Shelah, 1 Chronicles 9:5, Nehemiah 11:5, doubtless the same as the Shelahites. Numbers 26:20. Nelson's New Illustrated Bible Dictionary, page 1168. The references to Shilohites in Nehemiah 11:5, the New Revised Standard Version, and 1 Chronicles 9:5 probably should be Shelahites to indicate a descendant of Shelah. Genesis 35:8, Numbers 26:20. And Unger's Bible Dictionary, page 1015. The Shelahites are mentioned among the descendants of Judah dwelling in Jerusalem at a date difficult to fix. 1 Chronicles 9:5, they are doubtless the members of the house of Shelah who in the Pentateuch are accurately designated Shelahites. Shelah in Nehemiah 11:5. We have now traced Shelah and his descendants through the Bible and have arrived at the post-exilic period about 460 B.C. At this point, Shelah had been with the tribe of Judah for about 1,400 years. These half-breed descendants of Judah, with mostly Canaanite blood, which include the blood of Cain, had been passing themselves off as Judah all this time. As a matter of fact, they are still passing themselves off as Judah today. Yes, they can point to Judah as one of their progenitors and claim him as their father, but they are Canaanites of the serpent seed line of Cain. They represent, therefore, a curse to Judah. We'll now take up this passage in Nehemiah, where their names are mentioned, Nehemiah 11:5, and they are referred to as Shiloni. And Maaseiah, the son of Baruch, the son of Koholzeh, the son of Hazaiah, the son of Joarib, the son of Zechariah, the son of Shiloni. This passage represents some very serious problems that we need to clear up. If you'll read earlier in this chapter, upon their return to Palestine from Babylon, certain of them as chief rulers were to live in Jerusalem. Then starting with verse 4, it names the families of Perez, Phares, Zerah, and Benjamin that were to live and be rulers. Then verse 5 above included these sons of Shelah. Verse 6 makes it clear that all the families mentioned in both verses 5 and 6 are descendants of Perez, Phares, in the James Moffat version, the father of Lecha, and Laada, the father of Marashah, and the families of the house of them that inhabitants, the references to Shilohites in Nehemiah 11:5, the New Revised Standard Version, and 1 Chronicles 9:5, probably should be Shelahites. Moffat translation of verse 6, it reads this way. The sons of Phares who resided at Jerusalem were 468 in all, able-bodied men. You'll notice that Moffat enclosed in parentheses, indicating that it may have been added at a later date and not in the original text. Most people reading this passage will assume that because it is speaking of Perez, Phares, in verse 4, and then again in verse 6, that verse 5 is also the descendants of Perez, Phares, and it is not so. The subject matter goes from Perez, Phares, in verse 4, to Shelah, in verse 5. and back to Perez in verse 6. It is interesting to note that in the New English Bible, they place verses 6 ahead of verse 5 to make some sense out of this whole matter of verse 5. I'm going to quote the comments from the Interpreter's Bible, volume 3, page 773. Ma'aziah, Ezra 10:18, corrupted as Asaiah in 1 Chronicles 9:5, is descended from Shelah, third son of Judah, by the Canaanite Shua, Genesis 38:2-5. But only the Peshitta properly identifies Shelah. Shiloni of the Masoretic text, Jews attempting to change themselves into people of Shiloh, a place name associated with peace, rather than people of Shelah, the half-breed Canaanite son of Judah. And 1 Chronicles 9:5 is the Gentilic from a clan, the Shilohite, the man from Shiloh, which would be inappropriate since Shiloh lay not in Judah but in Ephraim, north of Bethel. From Judges 21:19, Zechariah is one of the Shelonites of Numbers 26:20, and the word the Shelonite must be revocalized as the Shelonite, Baruch, of 3:20, is corrupted to firstborn. And in 1 Chronicles 9:5, where the text is then deliberately abbreviated to and his sons, Boholzech, 3:15, Adaiah, Ezra 10:29-30, Joiarib, Ezra 8:16, Hazaiah, the Lord has seen, is found only here. End quote. You'll notice that it speaks of the Peshitta here. You may have never heard of or not be aware of what the Peshitta is. It is the Holy Bible from ancient Eastern manuscripts by George M. Lamsa. On the page before the preface it says this, containing the Old and New Testaments translated from the Peshitta, the authorized Bible of the Church of the East. Knowing now what the Peshitta is, and the fact that Lamsa translated Nehemiah 11:5 correctly, let's read Nehemiah 11:5 from his version. Lamsa is a native of the two modern cities which speak Aramaic as their first language. Further note made on April the 28th of 2006. Though Lamsa did well explaining idioms, I no longer consider some of his premises correct. I still consider his translation of the following verse, in effect, useful. Ma'aziah, the son of Baruch, the son of Koholzeh, the son of Neriah, the son of Azariah, the son of Jonadab, the son of Zechariah, the son of Shelah. Now let's compare some other Bible translations on this same verse, the New Jerusalem Bible, and Ma'aziah, son of Baruch, son of Koholzeh, son of Hazaiah, son of Adaiah, son of Joiarib, son of Zechariah, descendant of Shelah. The New English Bible, and Ma'aziah, son of Baruch, son of Koholzeh, son of Hazaiah, son of Adaiah, son of Joiarib, son of Zechariah of the Shelonite family. The New Century Version. There were also Ma'aziah, son of Baruch. Baruch was the son of Koholzeh, the son of Hazaiah. Hazaiah was the son of Adaiah, son of Joiarib. Joiarib was the son of Zechariah, a descendant of Shelah. And the Good News Bible. Ma'aziah, the son of Baruch and grandson of Koholzeh. His other ancestors included Hazaiah, Adaiah, Joiarib, and Zechariah, descendants of Judah's son Shelah. I think we've proven this passage of Nehemiah 11:5 is indeed speaking about the descendants of Shelah. The next thing I want to do is to compare three scriptures in the King James Version. I think you'll be amazed at the similarity of names. You will also see how some of the names were corrupted from one passage to another. I will do it in this order. First, Nehemiah 11:5. Second, Ezra 10:18. And third, 1 Chronicles 9:5. Nehemiah 11:5. And Maaziah, the son of Baruch, the son of Kol-Hozeh, the son of Haziah, the son of Adaiah, the son of Joiarib, the son of Zechariah, the son of Shiloni. Ezra 10:18. And among the sons of the priest there were found that had taken strange wives, namely of the sons of Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brethren, Maaseiah, and Eleazar, and Jarib, and Gedaliah. 1 Chronicles 9:5. And of the Shilonites, Aziah the firstborn and his sons. If the Maaseiah of Nehemiah 11:5 and the Maaseiah of Ezra 10:18 and the Aziah of 1 Chronicles 9:5 are all the same person, the Shelonites of Shelah had wormed their way into the Levitical priesthood. I am pretty sure that this Maaseiah did work his way into the Levitical priesthood. When the captives returned from Babylon to Jerusalem, there was a shortage of Levites for all the needed offices, so they substituted heads of families for priestly duties. There is so much history to cover during this period. There isn't enough space in this teaching letter to cover it all here. I do expect to cover it in the next teaching letter, though. This is a very critical era of history, and all the ramifications must be considered. If you don't understand this period of time and all that was happening, you are not prepared to study the New Testament. In showing that Shelah was well established in the time of Nehemiah, you can be sure they were well established in the time of the Messiah as Pharisees and Sadducees, which we know today as Canaanite Jews. Of course, this is only part of the background of the Jews, as there are many other factors to consider. In his book, Documentary Studies by Howard B. Rand, Volume 1, page 415, we pick up more of the story of what was happening at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Rand says this: certain ones, both of the house of Judah that had returned from Babylon, and some of the priests, intermarried with the inhabitants of the land. These intermarriages were severely condemned by both Ezra and Nehemiah. These forbidden marriages were made with the Hittites, and in this time produces a distinct racial type whom we call Jews today. In other words, the Jew as we know him today is not of pure Israel stock, but through the intermarriages in the day of Ezra and Nehemiah has the blood of the Hittite in his veins. This intermarriage gave the Jew his dark hair and eyes and the facial characteristics by which he is known and recognized today. The origin of the Jew does not, therefore, antedate the return from the Babylonian captivity, but resulted from the admixture of Hittite blood after the return from Babylon to Palestine. Because the house of David was selected from the tribe of Judah many centuries prior to the time of these interracial marriages, there are no Jews as such in the house of David. End quote. Most of what Rand is saying here is correct. He either forgot or had never studied in depth how the Kenites, descendants of Cain, had intermixed with the Hittites and several other ites to make up the nation of Canaanites. These Hittites, Rand is talking about, had and still have the serpent blood of Cain in their veins. So you see, it does antedate this era of time. Add to this the admixture of the Shelonites. and we are beginning to get a definitive picture of the Jew. It should be pointed out, Shelah and his descendants were a separate house dwelling in Israel. He was half Judah and half Canaanite, of the Ites including Cain. His mother, Bathshua, married him off to a female Canaanite, which is probably one of the only good things she did in her entire life. Who did Shelah's descendants marry? Of course, more Canaanites. There were probably a few Israelites, just like today, intermarrying with them, but they were basically Canaanite. Let's take a look at Ezra 9:1-2 and see who all of these Ites were that the priests and Levites were having intermarriage with and were instructed to put them with their children away. And the blood of Cain was in all of these. Now when these things were done, the princes came to me, saying, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands, doing according to their abominations, even of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites, for they have taken their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy set-apart seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands." I had intended on finishing up this teaching letter on the topic of universalism, but I had my attention drawn to something more important. You can plainly see there had been a change in attitude among these people returning from Babylon, from separatist racism to universalism, or these priests and people would not have been marrying strange wives as they were. I'm only going to use one reference to show you how universalism got started at this period of time, and it is found in the Peake's Commentary on the Bible, page 126. Before Jerusalem fell in 586 BC, some of the Jews, Judeans, had become possessors of a spiritual truth not known anywhere else in the world, that one God of perfect moral character ruled supreme over the whole universe. How many of the Jews, Judeans, knew this, it is impossible to say. Of course, they were a small minority, but they were either numerous enough or strong enough in their convictions to influence history. The great majority of the Jews, Judeans, held the traditional belief that Yahweh was a God of Israel alone. It is possible that even those who accepted the new universalistic truth did not realize that the two views were incompatible. Anyhow, it needed the destruction of the nation and the temple to free the wider truth from its nationalistic shackles. Peake's Commentary on the Bible actually accepts the universal view, universalist view, which has no basis whatever in Scripture, as the wider truth, while Jesus taught the straight and narrow way. The broad way, universalism, leads to destruction. The people behind such commentaries are clearly false teachers and shall be called out for their false teaching in due course. Some Canaanites, not Canaanites. Someone pointed out to me recently, I won't say who, that not only did Judah marry a Canaanite, but Simeon married a Canaanite too. Genesis 46:10. I had been aware of this, but in the book of Jasher, chapter 45, verse 2, it indicates that Simeon took Dinah, his sister, for a wife, and they had five sons. It goes on to say in verse 3, "And he afterward came to Bana, the Canaanitish woman." The same is Buna, whom Simeon took captive from the city of Shechem. And Buna was before Dinah. and attended upon her. And Simeon came to her, and she bare unto him Saul. It also says in the same passage in the book of Jasher, chapter 45, verse 1, that Reuben took a Canaanite wife. This would make three sons of Jacob that took Canaanite wives. At least, this is the way it appears from the surface. I know I have pretty well cleared up the problem with Judah in his affair with a Canaanite woman, which turned out all right in the end, as the pure seed line of Pharez and Zerah were uncorrupted. I covered Judah's personal life in detail in Lessons 1, 2, and 3. As soon as this was pointed out to me, I decided that this matter of Reuben and Simeon, along with Judah marrying Canaanites, needed to be addressed. So I went right to work on it. I didn't think I would find the answer so quickly. I checked the Hebrew word for Canaanite in both Genesis 46:10 and Genesis 38:2, and they were both the same word, number 3669, in Strong's. I checked in the Strong's Concordance and found it could mean one Canaanite or two, an inhabitant of Canaan. I next checked with the Jesenius Hebrew Chaldee Lexicon of the Old Testament, which said, "Specially this was a name applied to the inhabitants of the lower region on the seashore and the banks of Jordan, opposed to the inhabitants of the mountainous region." And it showed a different Hebrew word for each one of these. Investigating this, I found it quite interesting, so I consulted Insight on the Scripture, Volume 1, pages 399 through 406, on the word Canaan, Canaanite. They put both of these names under the same heading. I found a very fascinating and important item on page 400. Canaan was evidently subject to some Elamite and hence Semitic influence and domination at this time, as indicated by the biblical record at Genesis 14:1-7. Elam, E-L-A-M, is from whence Tamar came from and is also the father of the Persians. Any pure-blood Elamites left in modern Iran? Possibly. I then went to page 701 of this same book, and it said this of Elam. Elam, one of the five sons of Shem, from whom descended families according to their tongues, in their lands according to their nations. I believe this should clear up the fact that all of the descendants of Israel were of pure blood except for Shelah. This is proof that there were people of Shem in Canaan at this early time, for the sons of Jacob to find proper wives. In the lost books of the Bible and forgotten books of Eden, the Testament of Judah, chapter 2, verses 17-18, Judah definitely confesses to marrying a Canaanite. But in the Testaments of Reuben and the Testament of Simeon, no such confessions are recorded. In fact, the Testament of Simeon, chapter 3, verse 3, says this, "Then shall perish the seed of Canaan, and a remnant shall not be unto Amalek. And all the Canpadocians shall perish, and all the Hittites be utterly destroyed." If Simeon married a Canaanite, as we usually think of the word Canaanite, would he have made a statement like this? If he did, he is saying her seed, his children, should perish. I don't know why someone is always trying to prove that the Israelites mixed with other races, like Moses marrying a black woman, or Ruth being of another race, or Joseph taking a wife of the land of Ham, and that today we are somehow all mixed up with other races. I am getting tired and pretty well frustrated with the various so-called experts on the Bible who are proclaiming this, and so should we all. This was revised on the 14th of February 2001 by Clifton Emmeheiser. The goal of all those saying race mixing does not matter is to eradicate the pure white race from the face of the earth, doing the work of Satan. This brings to an end Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 7. Thank you for listening.